Wisconsin is a state with a strong and proud environmental tradition, and we are also home to many world-class scientists and researchers. So I guess it's really no surprise that a significant project like the Little Rock Lake experiment on acid rain would happen right here in Wisconsin. Hi, Larry Mueller here. We've been keeping tabs on the Little Rock Lake project since it started 30 years ago. So we wanted to take this opportunity to talk about the end of the main part of the project and what has been learned so far. A couple of guests for you today. Tim Kratz is the director of the University of Wisconsin Trout Lake Station, which is part of the Center for Limnology on the UW-Madison campus. His research interests include the long-term regional ecology of lakes, the interactions between people and lakes, and wetland ecology. And he's been involved with the Little Rock Lake Research Project since it began in 1983. And Tim, great to have you with us today.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Appreciate it very much. Carl Watrous is a research scientist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources and a research fellow with UW-Madison Center for Limnology. He works primarily on lake atmosphere interactions, and like Tim, Carl's been involved with the Little Rock Lake Research Project since it began in 1983. And Carl, thanks for taking time to be with us. Appreciate it very much.
Good morning, Larry. It's nice to be here.
Nice to have you here. I remember, I'm old enough to remember when this started, and it was pretty exciting time when it started. But Tim, you know, I would rather than start there with the Little Rock Lake project, I'd rather go back, because that area of the state has been a research center for, isn't it close to a century?
Very close. The Trout Lake Station itself was founded by Edward Burge, who had just retired as president of the university in 1924. And it's been an active scientific presence in the Northwoods ever since. So a lot of research has been done on lakes and the forests over the almost 80 years.
That's really cool. So a lot of really great research, including, obviously, the Little Rock Lake experiment. How did the idea for that experiment develop?
Well, if we go back to the early 1980s, people had started to see effects on lakes that we thought might be tied to acid rain. And so people were doing surveys of lakes that had various acidity levels, noting that the ones that were more acidic tended to be clearer, had fish were struggling to reproduce, and so on. But it was unclear what the cause-effect link was. And so the idea would be to take a lake, divide it in half, acidify one half of it, and then compare what happened in the treatment part of the lake to the reference basin to be able to establish cause-effect relationships between acid additions and what the ecological effects that we saw were.
And, you know, that particular lake kind of almost lends itself to splitting in half, just the way it's laid out.
That's right. It's a great lake. It's small enough that we were able to manipulate it. It's hourglass shaped, and so there was a place that where it was relatively straightforward to put a barrier across. Of course, that was a whole effort in and of itself. But it really was amenable. It also had the chemistry such that it was sensitive to acidification, but it hadn't yet been acidified by the acid rain that was occurring back in the early 80s.
So almost a perfect lake.
Exactly.
And within, what, 3 miles of the Trout Lake Station?
Yep. It was so the Trout Lake Station we were able to have as a base of operations, and it was very easy access to the lake, just right off of Highway 51, which is a major thoroughfare in the area. So it was an ideal setting.
Who were the initial collaborators?
Well, it was the EPA out of Duluth provided the initial funding and some of the vision for the project. We quickly developed a team that consisted of the EPA, some folks from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, the Wisconsin DNR, UW-Superior, University of Minnesota in the Twin Cities, and the USGS. And then that expanded over time to include folks from Canada, Sweden, Finland, and other places as well. So it was quite a team science project, and a lot of different people with a lot of different expertise came in to do research on the lake.
I think it's so neat that eventually people from essentially all over the world came to visit and research the lake.
Right. Yeah. It's a very well known lake worldwide in scientific literature, and it continues to be a scientific resource for us.
And Carl, why was it necessary to take an experiment like this out of the lab?
Well, cause and effect is hard to establish in a laboratory setting when you're talking about a complex ecosystem. There are just too many variables that you can't replicate in the laboratory. So field experimentation is a real powerful tool, but the reference basin is a key to that. You need to have a system that functions like your manipulated system, so you can account for changes in weather, changes in sunlight, and other sorts of things that are uncontrollable in the field.
Yeah, and this lake itself had some really a lot of other things going for it. In addition to its hourglass size, it also there weren't any homes around it or buildings, were there?
That's right. No, it was undeveloped, and so the human factor was largely removed from the experiment.
Yeah, and has remained that way for the last 30 years.
That's right.
Yeah. So that obviously makes for a great experimental lake. Tim, maybe you could talk about the logistics of the experiment for us.
Sure. So in 1984, we installed the curtain. Of course, none of us had ever done anything like that before, so that was an interesting exercise. But we were able to successfully divide the lake into two. We used the rest of 1984 as a reference reference year, so we could assess, once the barrier was in place, how if the two basins differed. They really didn't. They were very similar. Then starting in 1985, we dosed the lake with acid, and it started out at a pH of about 6.1, which is just slightly more acidic than neutral. And for the first 2 years, we reduced the pH to about 5.7. Then in the third and fourth year of the experiment, we further reduced the pH down to about 5.2. And in the final 2 years of the acidification part of the experiment, we moved the pH all the way down to 4.7, which is actually quite acidic. After those 6 years of acidification, we then just stopped adding acid and watched the lake recover naturally, so that we had both an acidification phase and a recovery phase of the project.
And a lot of really interesting data collected. One interesting part was the impact on the fish population, the acidification.
Right. So largemouth bass is the top carnivore in the system. And it was really interesting. Even in the early phases of the acidification, we saw some pretty dramatic results. The young fish, the baby fish that were born, were unable to grow fast enough under acidic conditions to be able to survive over the winter under the ice. And so we started to see failures of reproductive year classes. And that was as early as some of the effects were in the first stage of acidification.
Wow.
Then once we got to the most acidified part, there was just direct damage done to the fish eggs in the nest. And so it really had impacts on the fish populations. But one of the really interesting parts of it was, as the water acidified, we started to see methylmercury, this is the poisonous form of mercury, started to accumulate in the fish tissues, and this led to a whole interesting set of research that Carl took on, trying to understand where this mercury was coming from, why it was being put into the poisonous form, and how did it get into the fish.
Yeah, and Carl, can you talk about your findings?
Yeah, well, they were unexpected. It turns out that the bacteria that were feeding on the sulfate and helping neutralize the acid rain were also producing methylmercury. We saw large increases in the amount of methylmercury in the water and in the fish of that treatment basin relative to the reference basin. And that was another experiment that involved researchers from all over the world to try and put that puzzle together.
And, you know, some of this research led to, I think was the basis or really helped change a lot of add to legislation that assisted us in cutting back on acid rain.
That's right, it did. In 86, Wisconsin passed its Clean Air Act, and then in 1990, the federal government followed suit with their Clean Air Act, and controls on sulfate emissions nationwide started. Just a few years ago, Wisconsin passed a mercury rule, and we anticipate that the federal government will probably follow that as well.
Talking today about the 30 years of science that's gone on at Little Rock Lake right here in Wisconsin near our University of Wisconsin Trout Lake Station. It's amazing research and fascinating work done by many people, including our two guests today, Tim Kratz and Carl Watrous. Great to have them along. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer, you may have a question for our guests. Have you followed that Little Rock Lake project over the years? Wonder what it's like for a scientist to follow a project for decades at a time, maybe? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. Or you can post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Larry Mueller. Again, Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Again, if you have a question for our guests today, Tim Kratz and Carl Watrous, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your questions and comments. Tim, there's been a lot of specific data collected over the past 30 years. Can you talk about a bit more about that?
Sure. So one of the nice things about the whole lake acidification is that it has allowed us to make a real comprehensive set of measurements. So we were able to measure things about the lake physics, the lake chemistry, the lake biology, try to put all of those things together into one cohesive story. So we had crews that would go out to the lake up to several times a week making measurements of various aspects. And we found some really interesting things. One of the first things we saw is that when we acidified the basin, it became clearer. And so an already clear lake became even clearer after we acidified it. There was a large filamentous green algal mat that started to grow along the bottom of the lake. It was just a very obvious, very dominant feature of the lake.
Now, what's an algal mat?
So this is just a filamentous algal sort of, I almost want to use the word slime, that just sort of grew along the bottom of the lake. And maybe up to a foot thick in areas that just hugged the bottom lake and just became a very dominant feature. And this was something that was found in other lakes that had been acidified or that were acidic. And so it was interesting to see that we could replicate that under a whole lake experiment to again show the cause effect. So that was an interesting result. We saw that the zooplankton community, these are the microscopic animals that are important parts of the food web, just completely changed from the species that had been there prior to the acidification or that persisted in the reference basin. And from an ecological perspective, one of the most interesting things is that a lot of the changes that we saw in the biological communities were not a direct effect of the acidification, but rather an indirect effect that worked through the food web. So, for example, some zooplankton species increased in abundance, not because they were particularly fond of the acidic conditions, but that their predators were particularly affected. And so when they were released from predation, those populations grew. And so we were able to tease apart a lot of these indirect effects. And that was one of the take-home messages on the ecological side, is that once you start to perturb a system, these perturbations cascade all the way through various parts of the food web, mostly due to these indirect kinds of effects. Really interesting stuff.
Yeah, it really is. Carl, do you want to talk a little more about your research?
Well, we've been looking at mercury primarily, and doing that in collaboration with people in Sweden and Finland. And we're trying to couple that now to a reacidification that's occurring. And these low water levels that we're seeing are causing Little Rock Lake to become acidic again. And we're still scratching our heads over that one. But it looks like some of that legacy sulfur that was buried in sediments is now exposed to oxygen and to sunlight, and it's reoxidizing and going back into the lake, causing the pH to go down and causing methylmercury to be produced at faster rates than it was after the full recovery. Mm-hmm. So those are the kinds of things that we're trying to tease apart as time goes on in the future.
So this is probably something you could generalize it to all the lakes in northern Wisconsin, but certainly with the lower levels, water levels, that could have an impact across a lot of lakes.
That's right. And Mike Meyer, who's a DNR scientist, has seen indications of that when he looks at loon populations. Our drought up here started about the year 1998-2000, and for the preceding decade leading up to that, Mike had seen concentrations of mercury in loons, which feed on the fish, slightly dropping. But as this drought onset, and we began to see increases in sulfate, decreases in pH, and increases in methylmercury in Little Rock, Mike was seeing across the region a parallel increase in mercury contamination in loons. So it does seem to be a general sort of phenomenon that's region-wide that's related to drought. We still don't have a complete understanding of the mechanism, but we have a few hypotheses that we're working on.
Yeah. So if the water levels come back up, the lakes can cure themselves, is not the right word, or clean themselves up? I mean, we saw that in Little Rock Lake, didn't we? To some extent?
Well, the recovery in Little Rock from acidification was really independent of water levels. That was a particular group of bacteria that were consuming the acid that we had added. Those microorganisms compete with another group of microorganisms that produce methane in lakes, sometimes called swamp gas. And the microorganisms that were consuming the sulfate, the acid that we added, produce sort of a rotten egg smell. And normally the methanogens, the ones that produce methane or swamp gas, can outcompete these sulfate reducers, but we gave the sulfate reducers a competitive edge by adding sulfate. And so they took off and drove the pH of the lake back up again during the recovery phase once we removed the acid stress. Now, what's happening with this water level change is we're giving them another meal of sulfate, and they seem to be taking off and producing more methyl mercury. Now, what's going to happen in the future, we don't really know. That depends on what happens with our water levels. We've hit record lows pretty much all over the region in the Great Lakes and in our small lakes, even though they're in different watersheds and have very different hydrologies. And I guess we're just going to have to see how that plays out.
Let's take a call from Dave in Madison. Dave, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, love your show. And I might have missed the answer when I was talking to your call screener. Now, when you first started the experiment, were you able to control the water level on both sides? And if so, did the water level, like the evaporation or the amount of vegetation, differentiate between the two sides?
Tim, you want to take that?
Sure. So when we put the barrier to divide the two lakes, the water levels of the two basins remained the same in the sense that one basin wasn't higher than the other. The water, but we did not control the overall water level of the basin. That's a function of how much rain comes in and how much evaporation there was. But it affected both the treatment and the reference basin equally. So we were able to control for effects of the small water level changes that we saw during the actual experiment. The drought that Carl had been referring to, we had some ups and downs of water level during the experiment, but the major drought that started in the late 1990s and we may just be coming out of occurred after the experiment was done.
I wonder about the curtain that went down. Other people have asked me about it. How you actually got a curtain that would completely block the water from one side to the other? Did it have to go, under the lake bed, or into the lake bed, or how did it work?
Yes, it did. It had floats on top, and a long plastic curtain went down to the sediments, and then it drifted out over the sediments. And after it was in place and tied to shore, then we had divers put sandbags all along that portion that was sitting on the bottom. So there were many tons of sandbag that went into the lake, resting on the curtain to keep it in place. And of course, the first thing that people thought about was how ice affects their docks if they don't take their docks out in the late fall, and whether the ice was just going to take the curtain out. But for 30 years, it managed to survive.
Well, yeah, I could imagine that would have been something to think about. Well, this data, Monday, I should mention, by the way, Monday was a pretty big day for you guys, Tim.
It was. It was the day that the curtain, it was curtains for the curtain.
Yeah.
We took the curtain out after almost 30 years, and that was quite a project. We had a team of divers out that cut the curtain into manageable pieces, and a bunch of people in boats hauling the old curtain back to a dumpster that was near the boat landing. And it took the better part of a day to get it all done, and I dare say there were a few sore backs the next morning.
I bet. What was that? What was the material? Was it a real thick plastic, or what was it?
It was a nylon screen, a very fine mesh woven screen that was coated with a rubberized plastic. So it was very rigid. The company that made the curtain for us uses these or sells these mostly for to serve as baffles in lagoons of various sorts, like sewage lagoons and that sort of thing. It just suited our purposes perfectly.
Yeah, they have a pretty good advertising vehicle there.
Right.
30 years and is still going strong.
That's right. Well, about 5 years into the, well, actually, no, about 4 years into the experiment, people's nerves were still kind of tender, wondering about ice and wondering about beavers deciding that they could they could outcompete us. And we put in a second curtain that ran parallel as a backup to the first curtain. So on Monday we had double duty taking out those two curtains. It was interesting. The crew was about 15 or 20 people who were undergraduates, graduate students, and researchers. And I think, Tim, correct me if I'm wrong, I think most of those people had not yet been born when the experiment began.
Could well be.
Well, probably a pretty interesting time for them. Lee in Lake Mills has a question. Lee, hello.
Hello. Good morning. Thanks. See, I was wondering if your hydrologic molecule model included the potential in, input from groundwater rather than just rainfall.
Yes, it did. The USGS did extensive monitoring of the groundwater field all around the lake. They had dozens and dozens of groundwater monitoring wells. One of the interesting things about Little Rock Lake, and it's true for a number of our lakes up here, is that it was a mounded seepage lake or a perched seepage lake. So it was the lake level was actually above the groundwater level for most of the time. That flips back and forth with rainfall events, but the groundwater inputs were estimated to be about from zero to as much as 5% of the total water budget, and that that was all used to calculate the or to model the chemistry of the lake as it was acidified.
Fair enough. Thank you. Good enough.
Thank you very much for calling. You can join in too with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your questions or comments. Do you? I thought, you know, when I first heard about the curtain coming down, I thought, I wonder how much the water from one side mingles with the water from the other side.
Well, it was interesting. At the height of the acidification, it was physically possible to straddle the curtain and take dip a vial from one side and then dip a vial from the other side and see tremendous differences in the water chemistry. So while, you know, there may have been some movement of water from one basin to the other, it was a very low amount because we were able to maintain significant differences between the two basins.
Very.
Right. And we should also point out that the treatment basin was down gradient from the reference basin. So during those infrequent periods when water was moving from one basin to the other, it was reference basin water moving into the treatment basin rather than the other way around.
Okay, that makes sense. I'm wondering now about the mixing of those waters, if there's a way to say, okay, the water from one end of the lake is going to wind up on the other end of the lake.
Well, I'm sure it will. The full circulation will be reestablished. But you know, at the time that the curtain came out, the two basins were really similar in terms of water chemistry. So we don't expect to see any kind of dramatic change to either of the basins.
Why end the experiment at this point, Tim?
Well, when we entered into this back in 1983, we made a compact with the people of the state of Wisconsin through the state legislature that this would be a long-term but temporary experiment. And because we were putting a barrier across the lake, we were affecting the navigability of a state water, and that actually required a permission from the state legislature to do that. And this permission had sunset clauses. So from time to time, we would go back to the legislature and re-up the permission to do this. We had completed the acidification experiment. We had done a second experiment in which we had removed the woody habitats that's in the very shallow part of one of the basins and looked at the effects that had on the fish. And it was time now to make good on our commitment to the people of the state and remove the curtain and allow the waters from the two basins to reunite.
And you mentioned, and this is something I had meant to ask and forgot, but I'm glad you mentioned woody habitats again, because I thought that was a very interesting part of the research. Describe that.
Right. So we had found from doing some surveys across many lakes that lakes that have a lot of residential development tended to not have much what we call woody habitat. These are trees that grew along the shoreline and died and blew into the lake, and they're just in the very shallow water, maybe only 2, 3, 5 feet of water. Lakes with a lot of houses on them just don't have much of that woody habitat. And those same lakes, the growth rates of fish like bluegills and largemouth bass are significantly slower than in lakes with a lot of this woody habitat. So what we did is take one of the basins, the treatment basin, and remove as much of the woody habitat, these dead trees that had fallen into the lake, as possible, and looked at the response of the fish. And what we found was really striking. The yellow perch that were in the lake completely disappeared because they had no shelter from predation from the largemouth bass. After the largemouth bass ate the yellow perch, their growth rates declined. And we started to see things like mice and shrews and the occasional baby squirrel in the stomachs of largemouth bass, which is not optimal diet for the bass. And so their growth rates declined. And it showed that this woody habitat, these dead trees that fall in the lakes, is really important to the fisheries of our lakes. And it's kind of ironic as people build houses on the lakes up here, a lot of people come up because they enjoy the fishing, but then they remove the wood that's right in front of their lots to harm the fishery. And so, but the word has gotten out that this habitat is important, and I think we're seeing a sea change in people's attitudes towards it.
Well, I certainly hope so. And I guess that would be another vote, kind of vote for fish cribs are kind of serving that purpose, aren't they?
Fish cribs do, except they're typically put into deeper water.
Yes.
And so what they tend to do is congregate fish and make it actually easier for fishermen to find them. Mm-hmm. But they don't have the same ecological influence that this wood that's in the really shallow waters has. So it's a little bit different.
I was doing some scuba diving on a lake in northern Wisconsin at one time, and I was going along a shoreline, and the shoreline was sort of undercut in the water, and there were a couple of huge bass that were kind of in that undercut looking out. And I saw them, and later I came back up, and I noticed that someone had come to fish, and they were fishing right in that spot, and they were throwing their line out as far as they possibly could, and they were literally standing on top of a couple of largemouth bass. Oh, it was I tell you what. It was an interesting time. Well, what are you guys going? You going to keep researching up there?
Well, from the water level perspective, and for our mercury studies, Little Rock is one of our primary sentinel lakes. We relate the changes in the chemistry of the lake water to changes in the chemistry of rainfall. That's kind of the lake atmosphere interaction. And so we'll continue doing that for a number of years.
Ah, and Tim, same thing?
Yeah. You know, one of the things that made the Little Rock Lake project possible is we also have another project called our Long-Term Ecological Research Project, which started in 1981, and it's meant to try to understand long-term change in the North Woods. And so that will go on. Little Rock was an important part of that because we were able to manipulate a lake and learn a lot of important things from that manipulation. But just being able to make measurements over the long term also provides a lot of important inferences. And that project will continue. The agencies that make these kind of projects possible, Little Rock was funded by the Environmental Protection Agency, but a lot of our other work is funded by the National Science Foundation, and that type of funding is the lifeblood of allowing us to develop this kind of scientific understanding that's just so important for helping to develop and implement policy.
Well, you guys have done some wonderful research and some great work, and the minds that you and the other folks who came up with these ideas and then followed through with the research, I certainly are to be commended for the work you've done and the work that you will continue to do. And I want to thank you both so much for being with us today. Really appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to talk about this project. It was a lot of fun.
That's right.
Yeah, well, it was great fun having you with us, and thank you so much. Tim Kratz, director of the University of Wisconsin Trout Lake Station. It's part of the Center for Limnology on the UW-Madison campus, and he's been involved with the Little Rock Lake Research Project since it began in 1983, as has Carl Watrous, who is a research scientist with the Wisconsin DNR, and he's also a research fellow with the UW-Madison Center for limnology, works primarily on lake atmosphere interactions. I tell you what, really some interesting stuff, and I look forward to, hopefully we'll have them back on to talk about some more of the research that's going on at the station. Well, tell you what, when you hear about brewing with yeast, you probably think about beer first. That certainly was what comes to mind for me right away anyway. Maybe wine. What about biofuels? Well, there's some stuff going on there. You'll hear about it in just a second here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.